you spoke to an awful lot of people in laying the groundwork for this book.
Well, I suspect it wasn't that I wanted to write to the book, but I wanted to get to know my own country. And the advice on the first page of the book comes from a Vietnamese in Paris who was on the other side, who said of people in the anti-war movement that they must love their country or they couldn't change it. And he turned and looked at me and said, love your country. And so I set out to love it.
I think you do.
Sometimes I love what I see, and sometimes I love the people. I love the humor of Americans and the sense of mockery, and I do find them courageous. And I even talked to people who were all for the war, and I did not find them contemptible. They were survivors of a different generation and a different experience, and for them to realize that Vietnam was a war of crime was to challenge everything that had happened to them. So I found myself shaking hands with people after long interviews, and perhaps having a greater understanding of what this country does to its citizens. We measure people in curious ways. Yeah. You know, men are measured in terms of how much money they make and how well they pay the mortgage. And it is hard for us to love one another. It is hard to be good in this country. It is hard to be humble. I mean, people don't believe me when I said I've never read a review of my book. I did not write the book for approval or for praise or even to be criticized. But I'm in a different zone. They say, oh, come on, you saw the thing in Newsweek or Time. And I said, no, that wasn't the point of any of it. And they don't believe you because they really think that you really want more than anything else in the world to be Barbara Walters. And they don't know what to say when you say, how does an American be good? I want to be humble and good. I mean, that sounds too much like sort of Jimmy Carter's mushiness for it to have any meaning to say now.
You said that you, before when we were talking, you said that you went to 100 and some odd American Legion posts?
Yes, I went to many American Legion posts, and I had to. I mean, I'm a child of the Second World War. And, you know, it's so difficult in America for many people to have a sense of community or sharing. It's especially difficult for American men to be friends with one another. And this military experience and the perceived dangers and hazards and the gratitude of their country, the American Legion and the veterans of foreign wars is an excuse for men to get together, even if they really have nothing in common. And they need it. And for them to realize that veterans of Vietnam don't get together and talk about souvenirs on that terrific day when, you know, they broke the siege at Khe Sanh. For them to realize that Vietnam was a war of crime is to diminish their own lives and experiences, and they can't do it. And you can't live in America unless you understand and can accept that.
Mm-hmm. Can you compare the attitude of the Vietnam veterans to, you know, more in more detail?
Well,
to the
attitude? I have a lot of friends who are ex-infantrymen, and a very close friend who is a conscientious objector who went to Vietnam as a medic, and I mean, they are just much less hopeful about themselves and their society than people their own age. I mean, what Vietnam does, if you survived it and have come back with arms and legs and eyes and teeth and nose, is to take away all hope, in a sense. And I'm talking about the deepest kind of hope for yourself and for your country and your society. It is means that you will never really hear what a president is saying. I mean, I didn't find myself cheering as Carter walked that mile and a quarter. Why should I? I've known men of 20 who had to walk 8 miles with 90-degree packs on their back. I'm displaced. I mean, I'm kind of out of step.
To get back to reviews for a minute, your book was reviewed not once but twice in the Times, and both reviews.
Oh,
were,
boy, you were, never quit the New York Times, or the New York Times never lets you quit. You know, the Times knows what kind of a review it's getting in the Sunday section. And so they ask for a certain person to review a book, knowing that he will come back with a swift chop and kick. And then, of course, I attack Christopher Layman Hout in the note, in the author's note to my book, as remarking on his absolute boredom and apathy and world weariness with Vietnam books. And I just said, let's ignore Christopher Layman Hout, the New York Times book critic. He doesn't matter. And, of course, people warned me, oh, you mustn't do this. You mustn't attack the New York Times book critic, the Daily Book critic. Gloria, don't do it. But, you know, I didn't take on the army and the United States government to be awed by the likes of Christopher Layman Hout. So I attacked him, and he came back and wiped me out. And if there weren't lots of other good reviews, he could have hurt. But I'm beyond being hurt by people so imprisoned in their peculiar lives. I mean, he can't touch me. Although I suppose he's hurt the sale of a book.
I don't think so, because
he was outraged that I attacked him. Outraged.
What I got from reading his review was not that he had hurt you. I think what he did was he hurt himself.
Oh, I don't know.
By writing.
It
by
wasn't writing a book review. It was an assault.
Yeah, it was.
But I asked for it. I mean, I said he was no good, and let's not pay any attention to him, and let everybody write their Vietnam book, so that there will be a record somewhere after our death that, you know, that some 14-year-old will be able to see that people rose up and said, stop the war, and that the guys who were caught in it, of course weren't going to turn out to be the AmeriCal division at My Lai. And professional book critics like Christopher Layman Hout always have raincoats, and they never get wet, and I'm sure I irritated him very much. But I expected it, and he returned the compliment.
Yeah.
And there is a war now. I don't care.
You shouldn't. I mean, I don't, as I said before, I don't think he hurt you, and I don't think he hurt your book.
Did he hurt himself?
I think he might have.
I got a nice letter from William Shara, who wrote The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, saying, pay no attention. It is his specialty to do this. But gosh, at least it shows he's alive. I wasn't even sure about that for a while. Who knows on the Times who is dead and who is alive and who is stuffed and who breathes?
Sometimes it is very difficult to tell that.
Sure.
Yeah. Even reading between the lines, it's difficult. The view that you had of Vietnam and of the Vietnamese people comes across, especially in the book, as really unique, because you really saw.
Well, I'd been there in 1956, and I'd lived in Paris for 5 years as a correspondent for the Times, and knew many Vietnamese of different political persuasions, and although I never spoke the language fluently, I knew something of their literature and music, and it was the first foreign country I ever saw, and I knew how beautiful it was, and I knew this sense of order they had, and the esteem, the sense of self-esteem that they had. I arrived in Vietnam 2 years after the Vietnamese had beaten the French. And it was an extraordinary period to be there. And then to go back 15 years later, I mean, the first day that I arrived in Saigon and for 15 years had remembered the city of yellows and greens, and I saw it, and it was an extraordinary stab through the heart. I mean, I knew everything about the war that had been written, but I wasn't prepared for that great, sickening shock when I saw the city I love so much. I don't think I'll ever go back. I've never been to the North, and I've sort of been casually asked if I wanted to go back to Vietnam, and a member of a Vietnamese delegation to the UN said, don't you want to see how high the fruits and flowers grow on the land again? And I felt my eyes growing wet, and I was so ashamed because I didn't want him to see that I would see too many ghosts. And I said to him, I'm too old now. You have to send a new generation of people back. The place would be full of ghosts for me. I would look for a Vietnamese friend who would be gone. I mean, I would look for villages and they had been destroyed by the Americans. I mean, and when I went back, after 15 years away from Vietnam, I went places that weren't places anymore. They were free fire zones. And I would keep looking in the streets for Vietnamese that I had known then. And perhaps this time, if I went back, I would look for that nurse that had been captured. I don't know where she lives. I could never find her, but I wouldn't want to sort of walk through the streets of Vietnam looking for faces I couldn't find anymore. I couldn't bear that again. Once is enough, let me tell you.
Yeah.
So perhaps he was surprised at my refusal, and then he smiled and said, ah, you were so deeply touched by the war. And I said, yes. And he nodded.
Did you feel a special kind of connection with the other women who were there as reporters? Did you get to talk to them at all?
No, we were so busy. There was Kate Webb, who worked for UPI in Cambodia, and Elizabeth Pond, who was in Vietnam, who worked for the Christian Science Monitor. I think, you know, we never got together except casually. Perhaps we were afraid that we'd have so much to tell each other. There were women photographers, and Catherine Leroy of France, who was extraordinary and who was barred from a whole area of operations by a colonel because her language was so bad. I remember once when the army thought I was getting out of line, an officer came up to me and said, "Behave like a lady." And I said to him, "But sir, I think that would be more becoming to you." He was deeply offended. I was sort of shuffled off. On the other hand, you know, I don't want to give the impression that I triumphed over the military. I'd like to think that a lot of GIs did. I mean, you know, they regarded me as they regarded the enlisted men, as an undesirable species. I mean, they certainly aren't going to treat a female correspondent from the New York Times as badly and with the contempt that they treat the enlisted men with. I mean, somewhere in the book, we're talking about the lifers, which is what the GIs call the officers. I mean, what a word of contempt, and they call them the beggars or the lifers. And I was talking to a kid and saying how the lifers always showed me pictures of their wives, but I really didn't think they missed their wives or their wives had any meaning. And the kid looked at me and said, no, he didn't think the lifers liked women. And he looked at me and he said, you know, we are their women, meaning we are their servants. And it was an astonishing remark for a very young man to make in Vietnam.
Yeah.
But the enlisted men were the women in the non-carnal sense. I mean, they were the servants. They went up the hill. They came down the hill. They were the ones who died. They, you know, were bullied beyond belief, and I'd watch them, and they would have to take these orders. There is no choice in the army, you see. No choice at all.
That's what makes the analogy so perfect.
We are their women, he said. And he understood almost everything, that guy. And then I never saw him again. So, you know, for the next 10 months, I kept looking for his face, but maybe he went home and it worked out all right.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. He understood almost everything.
Yeah. You've been on the book publicity tour now for several weeks. What isn't being addressed that you think should be?
Oh, I don't think people talk enough about what it was like working for the New York Times or being a correspondent. People ask me if my stories were censored, and I say no, but I remember when the Times nominated me for a Pulitzer. And I didn't know, of course, that they had done this, because I didn't want a Pulitzer. I mean, the persons who haven't won Pulitzers are so much greater to me than those who have. I mean, if Harrison Salisbury didn't win a Pulitzer for going to North Vietnam and being the first Western American correspondent in North Vietnam and writing about the bombing, is this the prize I really want? Who rises from the grave? What Vietnamese village is saved because of a Pulitzer? Anyway, this editor came to Saigon and said, you know, I'd won the Polk Award, and he said, we've put you up for a Pulitzer. And I began to falter and say, I don't want it. And then I got that now, Gloria, we can't have this kind of thing. And then he said how good my stories had been on the Vietnamese, but maybe I should change the type of story I was writing. Start writing about the Vietnamese. Why didn't I try and write about what was working? What was going well in Vietnam? And I said, because nothing is. And then there was no, you know, sort of great pressure, but I think they were sort of relieved to get me out of there. They wanted more cheerful stories. They had printed the Pentagon Papers in 71, and they were very anxious to show they were balanced, and enough of Emerson's stories about Vietnam and the Vietnamese. What's working? Let's get a little upbeat music in those stories. And there was some pressure from the bureau chief, but it was supportable. It wasn't, damn it, you write some cheerful stories or you go out. And I had a quarrel with the foreign editor, and he asked me to apologize, and I wrote a letter apologizing so I could stay in Vietnam longer. I'd been rude on the telex. and they held a story that I thought was important, and I said, you know, run the story, I'm giving it away to the Washington Post. And the poor bureau chief tried to stop me from putting this on the telex. I struck him, and there was this sort of, you know, strange mess, and I had to write a letter of apology. Temperament, temperament.
Tisk, tisk.
Tisk, tisk.
The thing about having viewed the war from the perspective of one who spent that entire time here is that you can have read all the newspaper stories, and you could have watched it every night on the 7 o'clock news. And I don't think it is possible for anyone to really get a feeling of, and when I say really get a feeling, I mean to feel it in every single cell of your body, of exactly what it was that we as a country did over there, unless you read this book.
To them and to ourselves, but more to the Vietnamese.
Yeah.
It will take a long time for us to work our passage back, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is very clearly delineated in your book, Gloria. I mean, it is really
probably
stunning.
Much too clearly for the comfort of
sure.
the New York Times.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That they assigned a book to an Englishman to review is a good measure of how anxious they are for that book to be read. The English, of course, were notably pro-Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So be it.
It's an incredibly powerful book, and
perhaps I wrote it for my sister, who could never ask me what Vietnam was like because she was afraid that the questions would be so simple that I'd laugh at her. And although the book is not dedicated to her, a secretary at Random House came up to me the other day and said, I was afraid to read your book. I was afraid it would be too complicated. And she said, but you are taking me through it, and I can hear your voice, and I'm beginning to understand, and I think that's the highest praise. That's why people write books.
The question is not complicated. It is not complex. The problem perhaps is that it is too simple.
That's right. We prefer it to be complicated. We prefer to say the war was too confusing and I don't know anything about combat.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with it at all. The issue
in Philadelphia is very simple. I spoke to about 1,500 women at a book and authors luncheon. And tried to say, you know, don't be afraid. And women came up to me afterwards and said that they wanted their husbands to read the book. And I would say, no, I didn't write the book for your husbands. I wrote it for you, and if you can't buy it, wait, and somehow I'll get a copy. And, you know, but they were afraid, and they said, we want our husbands to read it. And that was a painful moment, because I said, no, it was for you that I did all this, not for them.
Thank you for writing it, and thank you for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to come and do this.
It's the happiest time I'm going to have all day. The honor is mine, Viv.
I hope not.
Goodbye, WVAI.
I have been speaking with Gloria Emerson, who has written a wonderful book about the Vietnam War entitled Winners and Losers. And again, thank you so much for being here. It's just been marvelous. Next week on Women's Studies, we're going to have another broadcaster from a commercial radio station, and Dr. Donna Allen, who is the publisher of Media Report to Women. And I will see you then, and until then, take care. This is Viv Sutherland. Tell you every woman's got to fall. shall.